The martyrdom of Tipu Sultan 2 centuries ago is one of the most defining points in Indian history and the ultimate in the Tiger of Mysore's mission to stop the spread of British power in the subcontinent. Tipu lived dangerously and died gloriously. With deft diplomacy, he foiled the intrigues and insidious efforts of the British and courageously defended his domain. But ultimately, conceited plotters and cowards won. His end came on May 4, 1799, when the sun was on its descending phase, just near the gateway of the northern side of the fort of Srirangapatna, where a few fig trees, ficus trees, surrounded by 145 naga, snake-carved stones, were mute witnesses to a most tragic event that subsequently changed the course of Indian history. Mohammed Moinuddin, Distortions of Indian History with Reference to Tipu Sultan, Proceedings of the Indian History Congress, Volume 61, 2000-2001. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to Season 10 of the Islamic History Podcast. This season, we are continuing our discussion of the Mughal Empire. This is Episode 10-9, The Company. British supremacy. The British first came to India during the reign of Emperor Akbar. They established their first trading post in Surat in 1609 during the reign of Jahangir. Their first factory was established in Masulipatnam in 1616. The British then built an armored fort in what would become Madras in 1634. Britain's second major settlement in India was Bombay, or Mumbai as it's now known. Bombay was acquired from the Portuguese as part of Catherine of Portugal's dowry in 1661. Initially, the British, or more correctly the EIC, the East India Company, were just traders or merchants. The EIC maintained small armed forces to protect their factories or trading posts. In 1686, the EIC tried to get aggressive against the Mughals. This was during the reign of Aurangzeb, when the Mughal army was at its full might and glory, and they easily crushed the British forces. All of these events were discussed in the previous season. However, 60 years later, and things were very different. As discussed in Episode 10-4, the British and French fought in India in 1745. This was the first Carnatic War. This was a European conflict that spilled over into India. But it wouldn't be long before the British were directly meddling in Indian affairs. In 1757, they overthrew Siraj-ud-Daula in Bengal and placed Mir Jafar on the throne instead. This was, of course, to protect their business interests. Mir Jafar was their puppet, giving the British de facto control over Bengal. Then, in 1764, the British fought against the combined forces of Bengal, Awadh, and Mirza Najaf. This led to the Treaty of Allahabad in 1765, which allowed the EIC to collect taxes in Bengal, Bihar, and Orissa. This treaty also separated Allahabad from Awadh, which the British then gave to the Mughal Emperor. And with this, the Mughal Emperor now became a British dependent. We discussed all this in Episode 10-7. Losing America in 1776 intensified British urgency to dominate India. Between 1767 and 1799, the British fought multiple wars against Hyder Ali and his son, Tipu Sultan of Mysore. They finally defeated Tipu Sultan in 1799. After Mysore, the British went after the Marathas in the north. This began a series of rather odd battles. The British would attack an Indian fort, which was often commanded by a European mercenary. The mercenary would put up a token fight before contemplating surrender. The Indian soldiers fighting under the European mercenary would urge him to continue fighting. The mercenary would inevitably refuse to continue fighting and surrender to the British. Meanwhile, the Indians would fight on without him before ultimately being defeated by the British. This was how the British conquered Aligarh in August 1803, and then Delhi in September 1803, and then Agra in October 1803. Finally, the Marathas and the British signed the Treaty of Sirdaji Ajangon in late December 1803. With this treaty, the Marathas surrendered their northern possessions to the British. This put the Mughal emperor and the Mughal capital of Delhi directly under British control. The Marathas and British continued to fight throughout India for the next 16 years. By the end of 1804, the British controlled Bengal, Bihar, Orissa, Carnatic, Awadh, Mysore, and Delhi. Both the Mughal emperor and the Maratha Peshwa were under British protection. Around this same time, the Sikhs were emerging as a rising power in Punjab. Initially, the Sikh community was a collection of individual city-states called Misals. However, in 1799, Maharaja Ranjit Singh began consolidating these Misals under his authority. This would inevitably become the Sikh Empire. In 1806, Ranjit Singh signed a treaty with the British. This treaty set the Sutlej River as the boundary between the Sikh Empire and British India. In Delhi, the Mughal emperor, that is Shah Alam II, was just a figurehead. Under British protection, he received a monthly allowance of 60,000 rupees, but his authority did not extend beyond the walls of his palace. The British were basically now administering Mughal lands. Well, Emperor Shah Alam II died on November 19, 1806, and his second son, Akbar II, succeeded him as Mughal emperor. Shah Alam II was the last Mughal emperor, the last ruler, to hold any sovereign power. And this sovereignty came primarily during the 10 years that Mirza Najaf, that is that Persian mercenary we discussed in the previous episode, during the time that Mirza Najaf served him. Shah Alam II was also the first Mughal emperor to be under British protection. And this ultimately led to the end of the Mughal Empire two generations later. Emperor Shah Alam II had been a patron of the arts and literature. He was also a renowned poet using the pen name of Aftab. His court attracted many famous poets, but he inherited an empty treasury. What little wealth he did have, he lost to the Marathas, Ghulam Kadir, and finally to the British. Listen to this excerpt regarding the EIC's growth in India. The company's army had expanded very quickly under Wellesley's rule, and within a few years, its muster roll had gone up by nearly half from 115,000 to 155,000 men. In the next decade, its numbers would rise again to 195,000, making it one of the largest standing European-style armies in the world and around twice the size of the British Army. It had also belatedly recruited an impressive new cavalry arm mounted on strong European and South African horses. Their job was to protect the slow-moving and cumbersome infantry and artillery columns from flanking attacks by irregular Indian light horse, as had happened with fatal consequences at Talagon and Palilur. Unlike the perennially cash-strapped Warren Hastings, Wellesley had no problem paying for this vastly increased military establishment. After the rural upheavals of Cornwallis's land reforms had settled down, the company in Bengal found it had a considerable annual revenue surplus of 25 million rupees. In contrast, Sindhia was able to realize only 1.2 million rupees from his poorly irrigated home base in Malwa. The Anarchy by William Dalrymple. Akbar II and his quarrels with the British. Like his father, Emperor Akbar II's authority was confined to the palace. However, unlike his father, the British did not even humor him with any form of royal honor or respect. When Akbar II attempted to assert his authority, the British were quick to remind him that he was their puppet. When Akbar II requested a raise in his allowance, the British increased it only slightly from 1.1 million to 1.2 million rupees per year. This was a deliberate attempt to humiliate him. The emperor sent ambassadors to King William IV's court to negotiate, but these efforts were useless. After lots of back and forth, the British finally offered an annual allowance of 1.5 million rupees. Well, Akbar II rejected this offer, claiming that it just wasn't enough. The British also decided to intervene in the Mughal succession process. As we know, for a long time, Mughal succession was based on fratricidal war. This practice was abandoned by Muhammad Shah Rangila when he designated his heir. Nonetheless, the Mughal throne was never automatically given to the eldest son. But this was the British practice, and they wanted the Mughals to do the same thing. They were opposed to Emperor Akbar II's preferred choice, Prince Jahangir. Jahangir was the son of his favorite wife, but he was not the eldest son. The British insisted the eldest son had to inherit the throne. Well, the emperor sent an embassy to London to raise the issue with King William IV, but once again, the British dismissed his arguments. This further underscored the Mughal emperor's lack of authority. He couldn't even choose his own successor. Though he had no real power, Akbar II still tried to maintain the symbolic idea of empire. But the British were always quick to remind him of his subservience. For instance, he once sent honorary robes to the British Governor General in India, but the Governor General refused to even receive the Emperor's emissary. The British goal was to demean and humiliate the Emperor. They wanted him to know that they were not his subjects and they were not his equals. They were his protectors, and they expected him to show them the appropriate respect. Visiting British dignitaries stopped bringing the emperor gifts as was customary. They even refused to stand in his presence and instead sat down right next to him. The British also encouraged the Nizam of Hyderabad and the Nawab of Awadh to declare their sovereignty. These two provinces had been effectively independent for decades, but they still paid nominal homage to the Mughal emperor. The Nizam of Hyderabad declined and refused to disrespect the Mughal house. However, the Nawab of Awadh declared full independence in October 1819. This was another significant blow to the emperor's authority, further highlighting his weakness. In reality, though, the Nawab of Awadh was just as much a British puppet as Emperor Akbar II was. The British also began referring to the emperor as the King of Delhi. In 1835, the British issued a new coin featuring King William IV. The British had been minting coins in India ever since the reign of Farrukh Siyar. However, they had always included the Mughal emperor's name on their coins. This new coin in 1835 did not make any mention of Akbar II. This was another slap in the emperor's face. But the fact of the matter was that the British, through the East India Company, was in complete control in India. Emperor Akbar II died on September 28, 1837. And just as the British had demanded, his eldest son, Mirza Abu Dhafar Sirajuddin Muhammad, succeeded him as Bahadur Shah II. Wahhabi-style movements. The Wahhabi movement is a complex subject for historians for a variety of reasons. It was a religion-based movement which was able to engage a large number of Muslims from Bengal to the northwest frontier province in a religious war, jihad. But whether this was directed against the British or the Sikhs is a topic on which historians have debated for a long time. K.M. Ashraf argues for anti-British elements amongst the Wahhabis who were behind the 1857 revolt, but Iqtidar Alam Khan has observed that, ideologically, the Wahhabis were not anti-British. Some scholars have underlined the coming of Sayyid Ahmed Shahi to Kolkata in 1821 as an important point with which a phase of the religious reform movement of the Muslims began in Bengal. Moinuddin Ahmed Khan writes, his advent in 1821 created an amazing religious fervor among the Bengalis in every nook and corner of the country. The Bengal Muslim believed with their heart and soul that Sayyid Ahmed Barelvi was Imam Mahdi and flocked to Calcutta to become his disciples. Girish Chandra Pandey, Revisiting the History and Nature of the Wahhabi Movement, 1821-1861, Proceedings of the Indian History Congress, Volume 76, 2015. During this era, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab and ibn Saud had established the first Saudi state in Arabia. The Saudis eventually captured Mecca and Medina in 1803, though they would later lose it only to regain it again in the 20th century. I encourage you to go back to Season 6 for more details on the origins of Saudi Arabia. An Indian scholar named Shah Abdul Aziz was influenced by Abdul Wahhab's teachings after making Hajj. He declared India as Darul Harb, meaning House of War. Shah Abdul Aziz called on Muslims to fight to regain authority in India, and he also campaigned against Shiite Muslims. One of Shah Abdul Aziz's disciples was a former soldier named Sayyid Ahmed Barelvi. Barelvi made Hajj in 1821, where he met a Bengali peasant leader named Tito Mir. Tito Mir became Barelvi's disciple. Both men were inspired by Abdul Wahhab's teachings and wanted to change things in India. Sayyid Ahmed Barelvi targeted the Sikhs and traveled to the Peshawar Valley with a small army. There, he declared himself Amir al-Mu'mineen and established a state governed by Sharia law. Sayyid Ahmed Barelvi experienced some success, but eventually the local Pathans forced him to retreat to the Khagan Valley. This is in modern-day Pakistan. Well, the Sikhs pursued him, leading to a final battle in May 1831 at Balakot, which is in modern-day northeastern Pakistan. The Sikh army had 10,000 soldiers, while the Barelvis were only about 600. The Sikhs won, and Sayyid Ahmed Barelvi was killed in battle. He was buried near the Kunhar River in Balakot. Now, despite the similarity in name, there's no connection between Sayyid Ahmed Barelvi and the modern Barelvi movement. The modern Barelvi movement was founded by Ahmed Raza Khan Barelvi. Sayyid Ahmed Barelvi and Ahmed Raza Khan Barelvi are both from Bareilly in Uttar Pradesh in northern India. The Barelvi movement is more Sufi, while, as we can see, Sayyid Ahmed Barelvi was influenced by Wahhabi ideology. His disciple, Tito Mir, returned to Bengal where he attempted to establish a small state as well. The British responded with a military assault in November 1831, and Tito Mir was killed in this battle. Another individual named Haji Shariatullah was a Bengali scholar. He came from a wealthy family, but he took a different approach. Haji Shariatullah studied in Mecca under a Qadiriyya scholar and later at Al-Azhar University in Cairo. He returned to India in 1818 and started the Farizi movement. His goal was to remind Bengali Muslims of their religious duties. Initially, his strict approach did not attract many followers, and so Shariatullah went back to Mecca to reflect on what he might be doing wrong. He returned to India in 1821 and revived the Farizi movement, but this time he included more of a social focus, which increased its appeal amongst Bengali Muslims. In the next episode of this season, we'll discuss some of the factors that led to the so-called Sepoy Mutiny of 1857. You've been listening to the Islamic History Podcast, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. You can support the Islamic History Podcast and get exclusive content by subscribing to our premium channel, Islamic History Exclusive. If you're an Apple or Spotify user, open the app and search for Islamic History Exclusive. If you're listening on Podbean, become a patron in the app and you'll get access to our premium content. You can also join by visiting patreon.com/Islamic History. I'd also like to thank Brother Zulfikar Sarosh for his research on the Mughal Empire and his continued support of the show. and thanks to all of our premium subscribers. Be sure to join the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group where you can download a copy of today's transcript. Finally, subscribe to the Islamic History Podcast YouTube channel for our video documentaries. Stay tuned for a short clip from the latest season of the Umayyad Caliphate. Until next time, my name is Muttaki Ismail for the Islamic History Podcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to the Umayyad Caliphate Season 3, presented by Islamic History Exclusive. This season, we are discussing the years 96 to 105 AH. This is episode 3-9, Origins of the Da'wah. Let's begin today's story by discussing Sa'id ibn Khudaynah. In the previous episode, we left off with the Umayyad regime nearly destroying the Muhallab family. Only a few male members of the Muhallab family survived, and they mostly fled to Afghanistan. The current Umayyad Caliph, Yazid ibn Abdul Malik, he appoints his brother, Maslama ibn Abdul Malik, as governor of Iraq and, by extension, Khorasan. Maslama ibn Abdul Malik remained in Iraq, and then he went on to appoint his own sub-governors. As you mentioned in the previous episode, Khorasan was considered a sub-province under the Iraqi province. One of these new sub-governors was a man named Sa'id Khudaynah. He was appointed governor of Khorasan. And this was pure nepotism because Sa'id Khudaynah was married to Maslama ibn Abdul Malik's daughter. So this was definitely a quid pro quo, keeping your family in power, that sort of thing. Now, Sa'id Khudaynah's real name was actually Sa'id ibn Abdul Aziz, but everyone called him Sa'id Khudaynah. Khudaynah means wife of the Dehqan, or the lady of the house. Dehqan is a Persian word for a type of noble or land-owning aristocrat. The wife of a Dehqan, or this sort of noble, was called Khudaynah. Sa'id Khudaynah, he earned this name because he was seen as soft and loving luxury. And there's a story where one of the local Turkic warlords came to visit Sa'id Khudaynah, or Sa'id ibn Abdul Aziz, which was his real name, and the warlord was taken aback by Sa'id's luxurious clothes that he was wearing. He was sitting amongst these luxurious cushions. And so the warlord, this Turkic warlord, he described the new Umayyad governor as Khudaynah with hair like Sukayna. Sukayna was the daughter of Hussein ibn Ali, and she was known for having a famous hairstyle that was named after her. There's a lot of feminist rhetoric about her, but that's away from the story. But nonetheless, the point is that Khudaynah, or Sa'id Khudaynah, was seen as a soft, I don't want to say effeminate, but maybe that is the right word, a soft, effeminate man, and his credibility was lacking. So Sa'id Khudaynah, we're going to call him what everybody else called him at that time, Sa'id Khudaynah appointed a man named Shu'ba ibn Zuhari as the governor of Samarkand. Shu'ba was traveling through Khorasan on his way to take up his post in Samarkand, and he passed through a region where the local Turks had abandoned Islam. Now, I don't necessarily believe that the Turks in this region apostated and left Islam. I'm thinking that they may have actually overthrown the Umayyad authority, or they fell out of the Umayyad authority, or they stopped at least giving nominal allegiance to the Umayyads. Generally speaking, the Umayyads weren't really too concerned about non-Arabs becoming Muslim. They really didn't care for it because that took away from their jizya and from their tribute. So they needed, or I won't say they needed, but they preferred for non-Arabs to remain in whatever religion that they already had. Nonetheless, this new governor, Shu'ba ibn Zuhari, he was very upset when he saw this. And this is why I'm thinking that it may not have been necessarily they left Islam, like stopped being Muslim and went back to their pagan ways. Shu'ba was upset because when he saw what the new situation in this part of Khorasan, he also noticed that the Arabs living in the region had done nothing to stop them. He saw no evidence of fighting or any strife in the local garrison. So Shu'ba was very upset with this. Shu'ba would later on be dismissed by Sa'id Khudaynah after receiving a lot of complaints about him. But this is just giving you an idea of the weakening Umayyad authority, or maybe not weakening, but the tenuous hold that the Umayyads had on this vast region of Central Asia. So Sayyid Qudaynah, he is now established as the governor of Khorasan. And as we've seen in previous governors and regimes, whenever the new guy comes in, he starts cleaning house. Sayyid Qudaynah was no different. This new governor of Khorasan was no different. He ordered the arrests of several men who had been governors under Yazid ibn Muhallab.